name's Izzy. I'm a playwright, a songwriter, and I'm lowercase sober. That means I'm sober, but not like capital S sober. I don't drink, but I'm not in recovery in the traditional sense, and I'm not an addict. I think this distinction is very important, and I'll make it at the top of every episode. I don't identify as sober curious or dry because I'm, like, sober. And I don't think either gives enough weight to how much I had to unlearn when I stopped drinking, but both are labels that work for a lot of people who quit drinking, and I think they're valid ways to think about your sobriety. So if they're working for you, that's amazing. A content warning. I'm going to discuss alcohol use, browning and blacking out, the gray area of consent involved in drunken hookups, and big emotions like grief, anxiety, and stress. Sex and romance feature heavily in this episode. Oh, and a quick message for my mom, because we're about to talk about sex, specifically the sex that I have had. You know some of this stuff, I guess, but please feel free to skip this episode. Please, please, please. Please skip this episode. I love you a lot. I'll probably call you later. All of that being said, let's get into it. My biggest fear when quitting drinking was whether my friends would still hang out with me. They're not my friends because I drink, but we did hang out a lot in bars. We did get drunk together in college, and I am so fond of those memories. So redefining those relationships was a bit uncomfortable, if only for the 30 seconds it takes to readjust after I say, maybe not drinks, maybe coffee? I don't really drink anymore. At all. And they say, what? Forever? And I say, yeah. And usually that's all that it takes. Some people I naturally hung out with less. Friendships I had forged in the dark, crowded corners of bars became unsettled when we tried to drag those bonds out into the light of day. Unruly when conversations strayed from the cyclical topics of what are you drinking, who are you dating, and general gossip. I gossip less now. It's a welcome side effect. My friendships that stuck around, they had something else. They are less friendships of convenience and more friendships of choice. They are hard-wrought and if not ironclad, they do feature some nice ornamental iron-wrought fencing. I am so lucky to have so many people to call when I need company or an army or co-conspirators. I'm so lucky to have discovered that the gauntlet I perceived my sobriety to be for my platonic relationships wasn't really a gauntlet at all. It's just a yes or no question. Does this fundamentally change our friendship? Yes or no? Most people, thankfully, are a no, but some contacts I haven't used in my phone for 6 months are a hard yes. I've had to change the way I talk about hanging out with people. My vocabulary, my social life, everything feels like it's been affected, which is strange because I really didn't think alcohol was such a huge part of my social life. My drinks of choice: whiskey sours, Diet Coke and whiskey, dry ciders, IPAs and stouts, white wines, margaritas, whiskey straight or on the rocks, rosé. My tastes weren't fancy. I didn't mind PBR or Bud Light. I actually liked Coronas and Heineken and Rolling Rock. I missed the White Claw craze, but I wasn't wildly impressed by them when I tried them. Here's how much I used to drink on the weekend. Thursday night, 3 drinks at office happy hour, 2 drinks if I'm going out afterwards. Friday night, 2 to 3 drinks at a bar with friends. Saturday, 2 drinks at brunch, 2 drinks at a party. Sunday, no parties, maybe brunch, maybe 2 drinks. If I go to every invite, if I do brunch twice, that's 13 drinks a weekend. If I'm not a social butterfly, 5 to 7 drinks a weekend. And if I'm too hungover from Thursday, 3 to 5 drinks tops. And I'd write on those intake forms at the doctor's that I only ever had 1 to 2 drinks a week. I'd lie without a second thought. Now, of course, I drink 0. Also, the above I thought was normal. Again, this is not a judgment on the people who are in my immediate drinking circles, but I drank the least out of all of them. Oh, also, all of this didn't count drinks grabbed with collaborators and friends and coworkers throughout the week. The last time I drank, I had 5 drinks over the course of the night, or 4, I think. I was drinking to impress new people, and that never goes well. And that's honestly kind of hard to admit. So much of what I drank to fit in with other people. And I'm super lucky to be part of so many friend groups where I live. But drinking to impress or to fit in is usually built on pressure that exists only in your head. Unless, of course, you have a quote-unquote friend who shouts, shots, shots, shots at you until you do a saccharine shot of Fireball or throw back bitter tequila. Fun fact, they're not really your friend. Some friends have also started uninviting me or just not inviting me to events with alcohol. to birthday parties, happy hours, etc., etc., because of my sobriety. Or at least that's what I suspect, because people just stopped inviting me places without saying any reason why. I find out about parties and happy hours at the last minute with an, oh, didn't she invite you? I just want you to know that if you begin to do this without telling the person you are not inviting places any reason why, they will just feel excluded and let down by your friendship, because that is honestly how I feel now. You may try to justify it by saying you're doing the right thing by not inviting them, which you could be. Some people struggle with alcohol so much that going to bars is really stressful for them, so you could be doing it out of a sign of respect. But if you're doing it to people like me who are sober curious or lowercase sober or dry, you're really only protecting yourself from uncomfortable conversations about something you'd rather ignore for one night while you get blasted. Or again, that's how it seems to me, because nobody's telling me anything. For real, just talk to people. The same thing happened after my dad passed away, and it's unintentional isolation. So I'm here to tell you that it hurts people. Ooh, I'm a little more bitter about this than I thought. Frankly, we could all stand to get over ourselves and take better care of our community, and a lot of that comes from just talking to each other. One of my friends asked me for advice once on how to be single, and I didn't know what to say. I suddenly realized that I very quietly became the resident single life expert in my friend group. I haven't dated formally in years. Maybe I've gone on one or two dates a year. Some of them the kind where you don't realize it's a date until it's over. Some of them intentional blind dates that turned into friendships. But I haven't been, like, trying to do it. I download all the apps, I revamp my profiles, I talk about people I like, and have crushes on. But it's all bark, no bite. And some of my friends have, in great earnest, tried to help me, to spurn me on to date more, to get me to put myself out there. I live with two very nice, amazing people who, during our time together, have been in relationships or have been actively dating. It's a packed house when they both have their people over. I get that same feeling again that I'm failing at some big adult thing when I'm just alone. No one-night stands to gossip about over coffee after I kick them out. No boyfriends or girlfriends or partners or anything. And my roommates are not putting any pressure on me. It's all me, so roomies, don't worry. You're doing great. I joke all the time that I have so many options being bi, but nothing, just nothing has happened. No one has confessed being in crush with me. I have not confessed being in crush to anyone. I hold people at arm's length. It's one of the few parts of my life that I don't jump in with 2 feet. I don't take risks. Releasing this podcast, which is full of vulnerable personal information, fine, that's normal. Writing plays and letting other people hear them and read them and produce them and do them, fine. Putting music on the internet for people to judge and critique, I do that all the time. Confronting friends about their behavior, when necessary. Living loudly, dyeing my own hair, quitting toxic jobs, signing a lease without seeing the apartment. Yes, and I'd do it again. Getting let down by other people through the complicated ways we confess our attraction to each other, I just can't do it. And I used to be able to. I used to be reckless with my love, my attention, and my time, messaging people that I liked them like it was nobody's business. I one time heard someone liked me in college, and I was super attracted to them, so I put on my hottest outfit, went to a party to meet them, and we started making out. And, Mom, if you're still listening, oh my God, stop. Please. So basically, me and this girl, we were like making out, and we went back to her place, and you know, things happened. And I didn't sleep over. One time, I was dancing with a friend of mine at a party. He made eyes at me. We started making out. We hooked up. And then I didn't sleep over. Maybe I was always a little guarded with my heart and intimacy. And events in my life have only made it harder to tackle that sober. For this episode, I came up with a list of my favorite drinking memories. They aren't really about drinking. The memories aren't really about alcohol. So instead, here's the list of memories that sort of involve drinking, but don't really revolve around it. My friends surprising me with a graduation party at the Dunes, which was this like abandoned construction site that looked like a bunch of sand dunes on our college campus. It was like a college campus thing. It's a very special place, but I think it's gone now. coming out as bisexual, screaming, running with my friends from party to party on a Friday night, not caring who heard, and then ending that night with a girlfriend? Shocker, we didn't last long, but it was great. Eating amazing brunch food in New York City for the first time, staying out until the sun rose over our college campus, drinking strong, bitter coffee with my roommates on the steps outside of our apartment, going to zombie prom. It was like prom, but you dress up as zombies. It's another college thing. Seeing countless shows and concerts and getting lost in the magic of live performance. Seeing my friend Jesse in LA and getting huge breakfasts at Universal Studios and meeting the roaming musician guy at the restaurant and having him network with us in the most LA moment I've ever had. Seeing my grad school classmates when they pass through New York City. Being present for my friends when they're in a crisis. Seeing theater, going to Broadway opening night parties, making out with my friends at parties, having bonfires in the middle of the woods, hooking up with cool people who made me feel wanted and safe, walking home from the bar in Pittsburgh knowing I was right where I needed to be. Alcohol may have allowed a few of those things to happen, but it didn't cause them to. Those moments were brought about by the people in my life, not the box wine or dollar draft beer I was drinking. I think I can now finally excise alcohol from the relationships and platonic love I have for my friends and family. They used to seem so inextricably linked, and now they couldn't seem so different and far apart from each other. There is one part of my life I still can't seem to remove alcohol or the expectations of alcohol from. Sex and alcohol are linked forever in my head. Drinking leads to sex, not always, but sometimes. It helps shut down the anxiety around a first encounter, and the first time I hooked up with someone drunk was the first time I associated alcohol with courage or bravery. But that wasn't the first time I felt courageous in that particular part of my life. The first time I kissed someone, I was sober. I was 16 or 17. I had never even had a full drink yet. I had just taken a yoga class with him. It was in the glassware aisle of Marshall's. It was just two teenagers confessing their feelings for each other amongst the best bargains the suburbs could offer. Then, in college, I was great at hooking up with people. I always felt in control in the moment. I held my own, even though most of the time I was drunk. Are there people I regret hooking up with drunk? Yes, 1000% yes. Are there people I wish I had just hooked up with sober? Yes! But walking into a party after pre-gaming, locking eyes with someone wearing an outfit I knew I never would have put on sober, and just sort of knowing in my gut I was hot and they knew it, they were hot and I knew it, and we were gonna have sex tonight, it was like exhilarating. But it also made me feel like I was only desirable when I was drunk or when other people were drunk. But it was also so much fun. But it also did a number on my psyche and self-esteem. But it was important, I thought, to be desired, to assess my importance against the list of people I kept in the notes section of my phone. Of course, now, as an adult person who is older and has more experience, even if it's just a few years, I know how I should have framed those moments to be about how unfair it was that people could only get over themselves and come on to me when they were drunk, and no one was doing it sober. No one except this girl who invited me to her dorm room once to play music together, and I totally misread the situation. Sorry about high-fiving you when you tried to hold my hand. Genuinely sorry about that. My bad. I actually had a small crush on you, but I messed it up. That pervasive and terrifying thought that I was only desirable to people when they were drunk is inherently untrue, but took forever to unlearn. If you feel similarly at all because of whatever or whoever told you that, people who only tell you they want you when they're drunk are people you really don't want on your team. They aren't people who will step up and do the hard thing in the moment. You need the kind of people who will tell you you're hot and perfect and sexy and that they love you when they're stone cold sober and pinned up against the wall of their insecurity. You need the kind of people who can summon up all the courage they need from inside them, armed with whatever therapy or hype music or group chat encouragement helps them get there. You need someone who, when it comes down to it, doesn't need to throw back a shot to marry you or decide to live with you. Someone who can say fuck it and just jump off the cliff and love you. And maybe that's a romantic notion, but that's what I look for in my friends, too. If they're not people who follow through sober, who can only find the courage to do the big, difficult things when they're drunk, I don't really trust them with the big, difficult things. I keep them at arm's length. Sometimes I catch myself hating this one person. Let's, for the sake of this podcast, call her M. For making me feel, for 1 second, let alone years, that I wasn't worth it to people sober. M really made it a point to try to drive it home that I was just nothing to her in the daylight. Once she was sober, I was a mistake, something to regret, someone to make less than. Out of respect for myself and not her, because to be honest, she's one of the few people that I have trouble forgiving, that's all the info you need. We can talk about trauma and being young and learning things and unlearning them, but because we're just getting to know each other, I'm going to keep this kind of surface level. To boil it all down, it sounds dramatic and cliche to say I have trust issues, but I have trust issues. I don't trust myself to make good decisions when it comes to sex because I made bad ones when I was drinking, and I don't trust other people to treat me with respect because people in my past didn't respect me when they were drinking. To synthesize it even further into a soundbite, though, the foundation of my dating life was built on shaky terrain, and that foundation was cracked by what M said to me. How she treated me as if my sexuality and attractiveness turned to stone in the daylight of her hangover. But I didn't realize it was her problem, that she was in the wrong for a long, long time. I felt for years I was trying to heal a wound I didn't really understand. A part of my self-esteem was so shattered, but because I didn't know the weapon, I couldn't piece it back together. And once I realized that in the way that all trauma sort of does, it all came back through windy avenues to her and what she did, it gave me space to figure out next steps, to fix what's broken in that part of my head. I feel like I'm just describing the emotional version of that moment in CSI when they finally figure out what the murder weapon is and it unlocks the case. I'm still working on this. I'll keep working on this until it's out of my system. It's hard. It's made dating hard and sex hard and even flirting hard. But not completely impossible. Maybe like 20% impossible at the worst moments. But just in time for this podcast episode, I feel like for once, it's just 100% possible. Every few minutes, I think to myself, I'm gonna start dating again, and I just haven't yet. I wish I could say I was above it, but I think it's literally because I can't drink on dates anymore. I have to find a way to break down my own walls and fears myself, which is hard, really fucking hard. I've never been a person who dates a lot. For all the hooking up I didn't date a lot of people in high school or college. I would just happen upon someone who I'd spend a ton of time with and occasionally hook up with. For context and the sake of oversharing, here is my official abridged dating history. I started dating in high school. My dad had just gotten sick. I had fallen in love with a girl freshman year, but she didn't stick around and I lost my nerve. I crushed super hard on a boy who I ended up dating, a bassist, who promised to be there for me, who made out with me in the glassware aisle of Marshall's. When we broke up over a text message, we made mistakes the way 16-year-olds do. I dated and hooked up and hung out with a bunch of people in college. We wandered the woods of my college campus, made out at parties, and had sex where we shouldn't have. My dad was still sick that whole time. The summer after graduation, I hooked up with a very nice young man who lived upstate. I would never see him again, despite a hot and heavy promise to try to make it work. He had a daughter. I had a very different life. It wouldn't happen for us. That same summer, M entered my life. M did her best to make me feel small and unimportant. Reeling from a confusing summer of hooking up with my ex, falling for upstate boy, and dealing with the aftermath of M being the worst, I moved to a new city and started grad school. Stressed from grad school, I couldn't even think about dating. My dad was still sick. And then, in the middle of rehearsals for my thesis production, all of my crushes swept under the bed by mountains of work and rewriting, my dad died. I feel like every time I was about to catch up to the healing that I had to do, life knocked me back just enough to make it too hard again. And I couldn't let someone else in on that, not yet. I had to be precious with myself. It was a survival instinct, and now I fear it's just a habit. College, though, felt like a safe haven for me to explore what it meant to be me and to be in love, to be in crush, to be attracted to people. I hooked up with many people. I didn't have many relationships, but I did have a few extended fling-type situations. I equated my sexual prowess with being mature and in control. I equated my ability to put myself in and then fix hard and complicated situations involving sex and alcohol with my ability to be independent and brave. I was Wonder Woman. I was Mr. Incredible. I almost didn't care who was hurt along the way until I hurt people. And then my tiny little alcohol-fueled utopia of exploration came crashing to the ground. And I panicked and recoiled and lost my nerve in a big way. I thought alcohol was the only way I could have sex, and I thought sex was the only way I could be taken seriously. I know, but like bear with my younger, silly, uninformed head for a second. So I thought, by the laws of seventh grade algebra or trigonometry or whatever, that alcohol was the only way I could be taken seriously, with sex being the crux of that equation. But what if being taken seriously meant I got drunk and pushed my own boundaries and ethics too far? That was unfair to me and to the people around me. It's still unfair, but I kick that thought out of my head as soon as it shows up. It barely even gets through the door anymore. There are people I want to ask out right now, but I get so paralyzed by what used to be so easy for alcohol to knock out of the way. It's like I used to have dynamite and a machete to clear the path ahead of me, and now all I have is a soup spoon and luck. And I want to clear the path ahead of me, but it's so much easier to get stuck in the weeds. And the weeds are like every little tiny fear and insecurity I have about dating. And yes, maybe I haven't found the right person. And yes, I don't really go out of my way to try dating. I'm out of practice with putting myself out there. And I originally practiced with very different tools in my hands. I knew how to date in the crowds of college, the thrown together haphazard couplings of apartment parties and clubs and classes, how to stumble from friendship to fumbling hands in a dorm room, how to make a lunch with a classmate last 3 days. Now I'm just here, single but not alone, in a city that amplifies loneliness in its crowds and headphones. In case it wasn't clear by now, I identify as bisexual, or queer, or pansexual, or whatever. Basically, I've dated, had flings with, had sex with, made out with, and been attracted to people of many different genders. It was a big shift from drinking socially to not drinking at all, but I've never really considered myself a super heavy drinker. But there were a few times a year where I felt I had to drink, and a few spaces I felt pressure to drink in. And a lot of those spaces, oddly enough, were with my queer family. Because I'm also attracted to and pursue cis men, and I'm a cisgender woman, I feel defensive about appearing queer enough to enter queer spaces. Meaning, I try really hard to fit in. And like I mentioned before, that doesn't always go so well. I know I don't have to, and it's very middle school to let these unspoken expectations force me to act a certain way, but I do! Not as much now that I'm older and I feel more centered in my sense of self, but still. During Pride, I feel like I don't drink enough to fit in. During parties with my queer friends, I feel like I don't do enough shots to fit in. During queer brunches, I don't have enough drunken hookup stories to tell. And I'm not alone in this feeling. Historically, gay bars were a place for the LGBTQ+ community to gather, organize, cruise, and create community bonds with each other. Alcohol and drug addiction rates in the LGBTQ+ community are still very high, based on everything I'm reading at the time of this recording, but that's also tied to self-medication for issues that stem from a lack of equitable healthcare for LGBTQ+ folks, especially trans and non-binary folk, and it's also tied to issues that arise from systemic discrimination and cyclical poverty. It's an intersectional issue, and if this podcast was 2 hours long, I would love to explore more. Maybe I'll bring back a more research-based edition of this podcast and explore it further with you all. But for now, I'll just say, look at the full picture of this issue. Don't just look at it in an isolated scope. Alcohol has gathered people together throughout the centuries, throughout millennia. Like food, it's a social magnet, leveling playing fields and helping to create common ground amongst the most varied of people. So a huge question that people in both queer and straight communities are trying to answer is, how do we gather and socialize without alcohol? How can we organically foster spaces that encourage the same things we crave from bars and clubs without the influence of liquor, beer, and wine? How do we socialize sobriety, which, outside of recovery groups, can be incredibly lonely across the board, for people like me who are not actively in recovery and for people who are? As more and more queer spaces are shutting down, giving way to gentrification, integration of heterosexual communities, and just straight-up change, the goal should never be how do we replace queer bars, but rather how do we provide options to the community? John Hirsch put it beautifully in a quote for a piece about queer sober places that is published on them.us. He says, "I think bars very much have a role to play still. I don't think they should be shut down or anything like that. It's not subtraction, it's addition. Creating more options, more spaces for each other." I'll talk more about grief in the next episode, but you're silly if you think that grief and other big affecting emotions don't also affect your ability to be with people. After my dad passed away, it felt like I took about 3 million steps back from feeling confident enough to date. Like I said, though, I'll talk about this more in detail next time. Maybe that's all it boils down to. Security and confidence. Me and dating and alcohol in bed together, the worst threesome in history, was just a combo meant to help me secure and bolster my sense of self. Maybe what I need to do is find ways to feel secure in my identity and strong in my confidence. Speaking of which, I looked in the bathroom mirror at my day job earlier today and made eye contact with myself. I had had like 4 cups of coffee, so I literally felt like I was buzzing. But I was slaying my to-do list. I was working on this script that you're hearing right now. I was doing everything that I had to do, and I was doing it well. Every few months, I have what I'll call a, "Oh shit, that's what it is," moment. Which is like when you say to yourself, "Oh, I'm deliriously happy. Oh my god, I'm actually deliriously happy. Oh shit, that's what that is." Which I felt for the first time as an adult after I got off my birth control, which was making me depressed. Which is a whole other podcast. But I was looking in the mirror at my day job and I was like, oh shit, this is what success feels like. Not to toot my own horn, but I have been doing a lot of good work lately and my heart is full of support and encouragement. And that is success for me right now. And I literally teared up because 4 cups of coffee made me embarrassingly emotionally fragile. But I walked around the office with my head held high until I rushed home to my apartment to record what you're listening to right now. How do I find courage without the liquid form? How do I tip the moment over towards the asking, towards the confessing, towards the interest, instead of just steeping in the what-ifs and missed opportunities and shots not taken? How do I do it without alcohol? Apparently, I do it like this. There are 2 people that I've wanted to ask out for a long time, and well, fuck it. Here's hoping that they listen to this podcast and recognize themselves in these vague descriptors. To the person I've known for a long time, I really treasure you as a friend, but maybe we could also try something new? Talking with you lately at parties has been long conversations and confessions of crushes. And instead of staying at a distance, I'm hoping we can get closer. When you're available, let me know. I can play the long game. And to the boy I keep messaging with on Instagram and rarely spend any time with in person, turns out, plot twist, I like you. And yes, I get all weird and awkward in person, but it's really just because I'm so afraid of coming off wrong. But seriously, I think you're super attractive and smart and funny. And if you're down, let's hang out. See if this goes anywhere. Maybe see that show together. If anything, let's become better friends. If not, totally fine, but promise me we'll never speak of this again. If and only if you're one of those people and want to hang out or go on a date, hit me up. On the next episode of Lowercase Sober, we'll be talking about grief, mental health, and alcohol. If you, podcast listener, want to reach out to me, feel free to shoot an email to lowercasepodcast@gmail.com. There's a list of resources in the description of the episode in case you're interested in talking to a professional about your alcohol use. Thanks for listening. Talk to you soon. I, Izzy D'Esposito, scripted and said all the words you just heard. I also edited and composed the music you're hearing right now. Love you. See you next time.